Hello, Internet! Welcome to episode 225 of the Assorted Calibers podcast, the Second Amendment podcast. There's a little bit for everyone. I'm Weird Beard, and tonight is my very lovely hostess, Erin Paulette. How are you doing, Erin?
So my choices for today were angry or exhausted, and apparently my body and brain have unanimously chosen exhausted. Therefore, I shall leave immediately for Nepal, where I intend to live as a goat.
I want to live as a goat. I didn't know that was an option. What do you want to be when you grow up? I didn't realize goat was one of the options. Especially Nepalese ones, because I mean, a lot of them are vegetarians, because that's also a part of the world that where you get goats are easy to come by because they eat them and they're tasty. Let's skip with the pleasantries and we can just dive right into why you are feeling exhausted in case anybody doesn't know.
Yeah, so a thing happened over the weekend and it was terrible. And in addition to it being very close to a repeat of something that happened 6.5 years ago, it also happened on the day before the Transgender Day of Remembrance, which is a day where queer people and friends of trans people reflect on the transgender people who have died before their time, either because of suicide or as victims of a hate crime. And while I do not think the perpetrator of the awful thing knew that, it was still pretty crappy. And yesterday was a turbo crappy bad day for me, for pretty obvious reasons. And everyone was asking for my opinion on the Club Q shooting, and it was really taking most of my self-control not to say something, you know, publicly, like, you know, what the hell do you think my public stance is? Have you not been listening to me for the past 6.5 years? Do I have to specifically condemn every bad thing loudly and publicly, else you somehow think I endorse it? And so, yeah, that was yesterday. And then today I felt better and I asked for help, and I have gotten help from some very generous people who have lightened the load, and they've helped me craft a wonderful press release regarding the tragic Colorado shooting at Club Q. And, yeah, are we going to get into that right now?
It seems like the prudent thing to do.
Yeah, okay. You know what? You take it while I catch my breath here, and I'll chime in as appropriate.
Yes, and per the usual ACP format for when dealing with very current events, we are, of course, recording this the Monday before Thanksgiving. And so, yeah, there was a shooting at a Colorado Springs club called Club Q, and it wasn't specifically a gay bar, I don't think. Every description I hear of it, it sounds more like it is designated as a quote-unquote safe space for people of the queer community.
I just Googled it, and the first thing that comes up is adult-oriented gay and lesbian nightclub hosting theme nights such as karaoke, drag shows, and DJs.
Okay.
So. You know, were I to speculate, I would say that the Q in Club Q stands for queer, but I don't know.
Probably. And the night in question was a drag show night, mm-hmm. and a gunman entered the place. The person was 22 years old, and I will say right now, I don't actually know the person's name. I did look it up because I was trying to find a little bit more information about the person, and so I was able to find it with some digging, but I do have to dig because the news agencies are getting it, and they're not putting this person's name and this person's face all over everything. Praise on you for that. Everybody who is participating in not putting glory to cowardice. But this person came in, began shooting, ended up killing 5 people and wounding.
Well, he wounded 17 people with bullets, but then more people were injured while trying to escape. Mm-hmm. You know, they were panicking and they were trampling each other, and that's understandable. So, I think up to 25 people were injured total, but only 17 were shot.
Yeah, it is a...
Shot wounded as opposed to the 5 that were shot dead.
Yeah, and it's a very common instance. And of course, also, let's not belittle that. The people that were injured in the crush trying to leave is just as much mm-hmm. the fault of the gunman as the bullets that were leaving his gun. Same thing mm-hmm. goes with the Mandalay Bay mm-hmm. shooting is... I don't know if anyone's ever broken down the numbers of how many people have died because they were hit with gunfire versus how many people died because they were fatally injured in the crush of people trying to leave through the various choke points that were the limited access to this concert venue. But many of the people that died in that shooting were people killed in the panic of people escaping and trying to mm-hmm. get away from the gunfire. Mm-hmm. And so
one thing that I thought was very interesting, and it's on the CNN more or less live feed of articles, and one of the survivors, his name is Barrett Hudson, he was shot 7 times in the back, but none of the bullets pierced any vital organs. So the gunman came in, started shooting. Barrett started running away. He was shot 7 times in the back, according to him, from the top of his back to the bottom, and it missed all of his organs and his spine. And he's saying, there's no way I should have walked out of there, and he's very, very appreciative for life. And yes, he is very fortunate. The reason I bring this up is it's a combination of the media likes to say that the AR-15 is this big, horrible thing that explodes people. And this man was shot 7 times and not only lived, but, you know, no internal damage, which is extraordinary. But also just the human body is weird
mm-hmm.
because I don't have the links. I'm sure you can dig it up. But you can find an instance where, you know, somebody soaks up magazine after magazine of 45 caliber rounds, and the only time they drop is when they run out of blood and they just collapse because everything stops functioning. And then you can find somebody who gets shot once with a 22 long rifle, and either it nicks an important organ or they just go into shock and die. Things are weird, and that's why we in self-defense classes are taught that you shoot until the threat goes away, because sometimes it might take only one bullet. Sometimes it may take all of them. You just don't know. And so I am very, very pleased that this gentleman lived, and I'm scratching my head wondering how the heck this happened.
Yeah, I would say two excellent examples on either side of that were I can't remember the name of the city, but the Illinois cop who ended up stopping a I'm trying to remember if it was a bank robber or all that, but the guy had warrants and he ended up engaging fire with the officer, and the officer had a Glock 21 in 45 ACP and loaded with I believe Speer gold dots, and he ended up putting an obscene amount of 45 into this guy, and it only stopped when the officer had rolled underneath his car as a way to get away from the gunfire, and he had taken several shots himself, and mm-hmm. the guy looked down underneath the car, and as soon as the cops saw the guy's head, he put 3 rounds in it, and that finally stopped him. But otherwise, he was just full of 45 ACP and did not stop, did not die. And then it wasn't until there was 345s in his head, which we will say is more than adequate, put him down. And then the other example that came to mind was Harry Whittington, who was the lawyer who was hunting with Vice President Dick Cheney, quite possibly while they were both drinking. And Dick Cheney swung wild and shot him with a 28 gauge shotgun loaded with birdshot.
Yeah, thankfully it was birdshot.
Mm-hmm. But Mr. Whittington actually had a heart attack 2 days later because one of the pellets actually migrated down into his heart and actually caused him issues. And it very well might have been fatal had he not been in the hospital at the time. But literally, he was wounded so superficially that they actually waited a little while before calling the authorities, possibly to conceal certain substances in the bloodstream. And the body is super duper 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 weird. But also, while the AR-15 is a rifle, and it is very, very impressive that this guy took that many rounds and survived versus handguns, where the survivability of handgun encounters is extremely high, something to the tune of like 80% of people shot with handguns live through it. It still is a 22 caliber high velocity round. And it does sometimes have instances like this where, didn't do any damage that he's not going to recover from. And I'm so glad of that.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the key points that I wanted to make was also, this is yet another spree killing that was stopped by someone who realized that I am the first responder. No one is going to come and help me in a time that is relevant to me right now. And mm-hmm. I believe it was actually several people charged him.
Yes, it was several people. But as of this moment, we only know the name of one of them. And his name is Richard Fierro. And he's a retired Army major. And so he was at the club with friends and family. And he heard the shooting, so he pulled his friend to the ground. He saw the shooter, and he saw that the gunman was wearing, I don't know if he actually had armor or if it was just a plate carrier, but he saw the vest, and he knew from experience that there was a handle on the back of the vest, you know, the drag handle, so that if your buddy is wounded, you've got a handy handle with which to drag them to safety and get medical attention. And so what he did was he ran across the room, grabbed the handle, pulled the suspect to the ground, at which point the suspect's rifle flew out of his hands. Fierro then said he started hitting the suspect with a pistol. It's not clear where the pistol came from. I imagine it probably came from the shooter because he was reported to have come in with a rifle and a pistol.
I'm looking at the CNN quote.
Here it is. I just started wailing away with his gun. He took the pistol away from the guy and pistol whipped him into compliance.
Yes. I'm not even going to use the bullets. I'm just going to use the side.
Fierro served in the Army for nearly 15 years and had four combat deployments.
And I will read you the quote of what he said while he was pistol whipping the guy, and it'll be just a string of bleeps. But yes, this is Mr. Fierro and anybody else who came to his aid. I've heard multiple accounts that he was not completely alone, though this story Correct. About grabbing the drag handle does seem like he was the one that initiated the we've got to do something, and the other people maybe followed by example, which is another great thing to think about, is you can be the leader, and you can be the person to let people know that if you charge on the gunman, it may not be the best situation, but if you're in a case where someone's spree shooting, you're already in a real bad place. So the idea that maybe you can stop them, disrupt the guy's OODA loop, even convince him to commit suicide, that it's all better than just being a target. So again, you know, Mr. Fierro, what's his
Major.
Yeah.
or did you want his first name, Richard?
Richard. Yeah, Major. Okay. Richard Fierro. That's you are a hero, and we are grateful for what you've done, and I can only imagine how many lives he saved by that bravery. And that is legit bravery, because closing the distance with the gunman is absolutely inviting getting shot. It's just like the statement that Oddball has made about knife fights. If you're ever going to get into a knife fight, you are going to get cut. If in the event that you are engaging in an active shooter, you very well could get shot. And luckily he took good tactical advantage, and it sounds like he was very smart about when he struck, and he was not harmed, but the other guy sure was, and he is in the hospital. So
good.
Yeah.
Speaking of the murderer, do you want to say the line weird, or shall I?
Why don't you say the line?
The suspect was known to law enforcement.
Yes. I wasn't quite exactly sure what you're going on, but oh yeah, no, you mentioned this earlier. Yeah, no, that, funny. And actually, it brings to mind an article that I frequently link in my weird audio fisks of the myth of the virgin killer. And mm-hmm. the long, the short of it is that when you get to a point where somebody is a murderer, in this case, it's really more talking about street violence than a spree killer, they almost always escalate their way up into this. Spree killers tend to be a little bit different. They are often known to law enforcement, though in many instances they don't necessarily have direct law enforcement involvement, but it's 50-50. But
yeah, well, this guy, as recently as last year, he built a bomb and held his mother hostage, and the police came and surrounded the house, and he was talking real big about blowing himself up if they breached, and they somehow talked him out of the house, and they arrested him. And so you may be wondering, well, if he was arrested, how was he able to pass the background check in order to buy his guns? And we've got a linked article here, and I'm quoting from that article. His arrest in connection to the bomb threat would not have shown up in background checks because the case was never adjudicated, the charges were dropped, and the records were sealed. Weird. I'm sure I speak for you too, but I am getting really
friggin'
tired of law enforcement knowing about these guys, not doing their job, and allowing them to commit further atrocities.
Yeah, I don't understand the justification of this, especially when we talk of stories of, you know, gun owners getting harassed for, you know, for having, you know, the wrong kind of magazines or improper permitting or those sort of things, when there are people that have actually done actual violence. And it's not even like I could almost understand. I don't agree with it, but I can almost understand how we have talked about the policing in high crime areas where police interaction is much higher in that area, but it's almost always for more minor crimes. And I can understand it, but I don't agree with it, because if you want to be a cop, you should want to be a cop. And and the parts of being a cop that are parts that are things that I don't want to do, but I don't want to be a cop, shouldn't be a deterrent, such as trying to arrest violent criminals and get them off the street, versus harassing people for having too much window tint or having their stereo turned up too loud in their car. But this guy was already in custody. He was arrested and he was charged.
And it wasn't just minor things. It wasn't a pattern of, I mean, clearly he did escalate. But the point being is holding your mom hostage and threatening to blow up the house in which she lived and you along with it. This is not a minor thing. This is felony level stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it just, it echoes on to the nonsense of Parkland, where even the shooter himself tried to turn himself in and the FBI and law enforcement did nothing. What are we doing here? But yeah, so again, the shooter lawfully bought their guns and paid for them with a background check. He complied with Colorado's background check laws. Unfortunately, I couldn't find any information directly, but I couldn't find anything that said that it is illegal to carry a firearm in Colorado in an establishment that serves alcohol, which I assume Club Q is.
Based on my research, which is not at all exhaustive, there is no law that specifically forbids it. However, they could have been a posted gun-free zone.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something in the Colorado law about other administrative whatevers may apply. I'm sorry, what did you say?
They have binding signage there?
That I don't know. I've been busy doing other things.
I'm not going to dig during the show to see if they have binding signage, but then again, also at the same time, many times people won't be aware. They'll see the gun-free zone sign and they'll be like, "Oh, I clearly have to comply with that," when in many states you don't. I have absolutely walked right through gun-free zone signs while carrying a gun here in Massachusetts because I know there's no binding signages and I know that my concealment options are good. And if they tell me to leave, I know how to do that too.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I don't think there's any more. Well, there's one more aspect that I wanted to put is that, I mean, we don't know the motivation of the shooter. I've heard a couple of theories, but they are thin. So I will wait until somebody comes up with something. It's certainly, this was somebody who in all accounts say that their online presence was very minimal, which is kind of an oddity these days, especially for somebody in their 20s. But there's a very real possibility that this was a targeted attack against the queer community. And one must remember that it's pretty hard to find a person who couldn't have an angle for a hate crime and for an attack, whether it be the member, you know, the religion that you're a member of, whether it be your sexuality, whether it be your race. And that even goes as far as there are black supremacists and Hispanic supremacists and other people who absolutely hate white people. So even if you are the majority here in the United States, that doesn't necessarily guarantee your safety, or at least guarantee that there's not some nut job out there who might want you to die for completely arbitrary reasons. And so this is just another reason to think about security and safety and just being vigilant. And it sucks to say that when, you know, especially these guys were out watching a drag show. They were out having a good time. And the idea of being concerned about a gunman walking in and shooting the place up in a just world shouldn't cross their mind, but that is what happened. And I could just leave it without saying that as well, is this can happen to you. It may not. Don't live your life in fear, but you should always have a contingency, and you know, have fun with it. I know I heard one person say about the zombie survivalist, you know, really meme. It's silly, it's goofy, but it is more fun to think about a zombie attack than about a hate-filled, bigoted gunman trying to kill you. But meanwhile, you could come up with tactics and all the same.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's all. So just, yeah, be aware of your exits. Be aware of what's cover and what's concealment. And just have ideas. And if you could legally carry a gun there, carry your gun there. And if you can't legally carry your gun there, I wouldn't do that. But boy, you can hide a gun just about anywhere. So, you know, unless they have metal detectors, how would they find out? But don't do that at all, because that'd be against the rules. And speaking about against the rules, the other topic that I wanted to, actually, speaking of hate-filled bigots, I forgot I adjusted the show notes for this. But this is a story that comes from Bearing Arms, and we're seeing a bunch of this cropping up in the post-Bruin world.
They mad.
Yeah. And Democrat New Jersey Assemblyman makes racist remarks during carry bill meeting. And this Assemblyman's name is John McKeon
is how I would pronounce that.
Okay, well that's I'll trust you on that. His words are, does anybody really want to put more guns in the hands of people that live in Patterson and Newark and Elizabeth and Camden? To say here, all the money you're charging isn't fair. That will make things safer.
That's one of those, stealth racial remarks, because until you know the ethnic makeup of those towns, on the face of it, it doesn't sound terrible. But courtesy of Don Petrolino of Bearing Arms, he's actually given us the statistics here. So, yeah, I'm going to be boring. I'm going to read some statistics. So, Patterson, 8.6% white, 29.4% black, 57.2% Hispanic. So, majority of Hispanics in Patterson, and John McKeon doesn't want them to have guns. Newark, white 10.7%, black 50.2%, Hispanic 34.1%. Yeah, he doesn't want either of those demographics to have guns. Elizabeth, New Jersey, where my grandmother lived for many years, white 14.1%, black 19.7%, Hispanic a whopping 60.9%. And we certainly don't want those, you know, 61% of Hispanic people to legally own firearms. Camden, white 5.3%, black 47.8%, and Hispanic 42.5%. Like, you know, 95% of the city is black or brown. God forbid that these peaceable, law-abiding people should be allowed to legally own guns.
And it's an extremely consistent trait. Back when Massachusetts was May issue, and I love saying that in the past tense. If the two towns over is a town that does not have a majority white population, and that's a town where you cannot couldn't have got a concealed carry permit unless you knew somebody in high places. Same thing goes with the town that I first moved to when I moved down here, where I got turned into the activist that I am today because I was denied a permit by someone who didn't even know my name. And that community had a much more mixed demographic than where I live right now. And so it's absolutely an instance of, if you are one of the towns that is known for known for a gathering place of the minority of a minority population, then that is one of the towns where the chief of police is going to screw with you when it came to your applying for a carry permit. And it seems to be that is the case also in New Jersey as well, because we can't have these people owning guns. And we are. I haven't been following it that much, but Stephen Gutowski of The Reload had in his latest episode was covering some court cases where people are arguing the historical tests as Judge Thomas has prescribed, and they are pointing out the fact that we should be able to keep our gun laws because they were disarming blacks and Jews and natives and Catholics in the past at the time of the ratification of the Second Amendment. So therefore we should still be able to racistly discriminate against people. Okay. Is that the hill that you want to die on? Is that how you want to frame this? It's true, but I thought that was the quiet part you weren't supposed to say out loud. So, moving on to the last topic that I wanted to discuss, which is the fallout for ballot measure 114 in Oregon. And we talked about this last week, but I believe it's officially passed. And again, like all gun control measures in a deep blue anti-gun state, it has passed just barely by either 1 or 2 points. And but the big issue is that it may in fact go into effect very, very soon. One account that I have read says that it may take effect in December 8th. And of course, this measure has, let's go down the list here, a fee of up to $65 for a pistol purchase permit that needs a photo ID, fingerprints, a training course, a background check, and then furthermore, there is a good moral character clause added onto this. And then it also bans the sale of magazines, though it does not ban the possession of magazines. You just can't buy new magazines and possibly have them transferred to you.
You can't sell them either.
Yes. At least not within the state. You could put them up on GunBroker.
Probably, but I wouldn't want to risk that, to be honest.
But the big concern that's going on right now is that the ballot measure, which of course was a rush job because they always are, is that they really have no provisions to make this happen, and they haven't quite drafted it all yet. So in theory, it will suddenly be illegal to purchase a firearm without a permit in Oregon. And there is no framework for creating the permits. So therefore, essentially buying or trading a gun is illegal, at least until they can come up with the system. And so this will be rot for challenge. And of course, the Second Amendment Foundation is already bearing down on them. But this is just another instance of just gun control laws being really hot garbage and not very well thought through.
Ah, here we go. As we've said before, the issuance, no, we haven't said that before. As we said before, you do need a permit, and I'm honestly surprised it's only $65. It seems very reasonable. I figured it would be triple digits. But to get this permit, you do have to get a live fire training that is offered only by law enforcement certified instructors. But here's the thing. There's nothing in the initiative that requires law enforcement agencies to actually offer this certification. And the law enforcement is already understaffed. And as I think I said last week, it'll cost like, you know, $50 million for the first 2 years. It's going to be a huge expense, which is why so many sheriffs are just going, nope, not going to do it. You know, even if we wanted to, which we don't, we couldn't. We just don't have the money and the manpower. It's, Yeah, and yeah, according to this, according to the law, you must complete the live fire training before you can even apply for the permit. And so for first-time gun owners, this is going to be difficult in order to get a gun for the training and then find the certified trainer. And yeah, according to a lawyer who's breaking down all the problems with this, it's likely that implementing this law will completely halt all gun sales in the state of Oregon for years. And while I don't think that was actually the point of the law, I'm sure that the people who passed it are not bothered by this.
No.
It's like, oh, hey, that's a feature, not a bug.
Though at the same time, many of the sheriffs are saying that they're not going to enforce the law, and it could very well be a situation where I have heard it's it. I have not set foot in the state of Colorado since their magazine ban came into place. But I have heard that you can even walk into gun shops and they will have quote unquote illegal high capacity magazines just up for sale because the police aren't going to enforce it. And so if the police aren't going to enforce it, who's going to say that that's a crime and you need to be punished for it?
Hooray for passing toothless laws.
Mm-hmm. But meanwhile, the Oregon has been their NICS checks are up like a gazillion percentage because everyone's going, all right, well, I'm going to buy my guns now before I need the permit for them. And again, you could still have the magazines and even take them to the range for shooting if you have a quote unquote large capacity magazine. So yeah, get them while you can. All right, now let's switch some gears into some more fun topics. The last time I sat down with Ian McCollum, I was talking to him about his new book, Pistols of the Warlords. And I decided to return to talk to him more about the trials and tribulations of actually getting this book published. I am very pleased to welcome back to the Assorted Calibers podcast, Ian McCollum, of course, from Forgotten Weapons and Headstamp Publishing. And how you doing, Ian?
Hey, I'm doing pretty well. A little busy around here.
Yeah, you are an extremely busy man, and that should come to surprise to nobody. If you don't know that Ian is extremely busy, you're not following him. Because, oh, hi, I'm in Prague. Hi, I'm in Arizona. Hi, I'm in France. So, what I wanted to talk to you about today is, of course, the last time you were on, we were talking about your Pistols of the Warlord book on Headstamp Publishing.
Yes.
And then I've done this with several people, and I find it to be a really fun interview, is that when we were talking about it, you were just starting the Kickstarter and starting the funding, and I will let you know that I dove in on that, and my book has arrived and it is gorgeous. I couldn't recommend Headstamp Publishing more. I mean, you really do amazing work.
Thank you very much.
But it was a lot longer than you expected for many reasons. And you bumped into a lot of bumps in the road. And I thought I'd talk to you about that.
So, yeah, we had a lot of stuff. The single biggest thing, and this should come as a surprise to nobody, was COVID. Mm-hmm. First off, COVID was actually a really we lucked out on the production of the book because James and I went and did the photography for the Warlords book in February of 2020. So we got back from our photography trip and a couple weeks later, the world just shut down, which was kind of nice for me, or I had a nice plan going there because I was then able to spend the first year of COVID essentially writing and completing Pistols of the Warlords. If we'd waited a month to do the photography, that book would have been thrown horribly off track. But after we did the Kickstarter, it was by a huge margin our most successful Kickstarter to date. We did $1.5 million on Kickstarter, which is mind-boggling on that book. But then we get the thing to print, and we started running into some additional issues. Some of them were COVID. You know, China had a zero COVID policy, still does, that involved shutting down whole cities for weeks at a time. And we had some issues with the city where we were printing it in having that sort of shutdown, which would delay production. And then the thing that hit us that, and maybe this is total naivete, but it had not even occurred to us, was censorship. So this was the second book that we'd printed in China. And a bunch of Vickers guidebooks have also been printed in China, although not at this same printer. And we'd never had, like, censorship had never come up. And in retrospect, that's because we were doing books that had nothing to do with China. Chinese censorship is all about maintaining a particular history and vision of China. And so once we get in there with a book about Chinese history, essentially, the censorship comes out of the woodwork. And where it really hit us were the maps that we were planning to include with the book. We got back a number of, well, we got pictures. We didn't actually get the physical maps back, but we got back a number of marked up map images with a whole bunch of changes, very helpfully in Chinese, which we couldn't actually read. But it became pretty clear that what they wanted us to do were a number of things. They wanted us to add, you know, you've probably heard of those little islands off the coast of China in the South China Sea that China is either creating from scratch or building up from little tiny atolls into islands that they can build infrastructure on and put some people on and thus use to expand Chinese territorial waters claims. Well, they wanted us to put those islands on our maps, which are intended to represent China in the 1920s. And those islands are basically BS today. And they definitely have no place being on a 1920s or 1930s map of China. So we had those. They wanted us to change some of the provincial borders within China to match current day provincial borders. They had some issues with us labeling things like the Mongolian Autonomous Region, which is not a thing anymore, but it was during the Republic of China in the teens and 20s and 30s and 40s. Essentially, they wanted us to take our historical maps and make them match the current day official map of China, which is nonsense. And our reaction to that was, how about no? And where we had originally been planning to include these maps as pages in the book, we decided to pull them out of the book, print them as a separate insert sheet, and we could then print them in the United States and then include them alongside the book. And frankly, I think we're really lucky that they didn't seem to be that interested in the text of the book. I believe the only change that was requested to the text of the book, which I did make because it wasn't a big deal to me, was to put Republic of China in quotations in one spot in the text. And that was like, you know what, if I can do that and you stop looking at it, that's fine. We actually have a big picture in the book of Mao and Chiang Kai-shek standing side by side in the 1940s. Or 30s. I don't remember the exact date on the picture now, but once we realized that, oh, hey, the censors are going to look at this to make sure it's appropriately interpreting Chinese history, I was sure that that picture would get us in trouble. And they never brought it up. So we didn't really want to talk about this until the books were actually physically in our hands here and, you know, out of the Chinese government's reach. But now they have arrived and they've all shipped out. You said you got yours. Everyone else should have now as well.
Yeah, all the members of ACP who ordered it all have theirs as well.
Excellent. I'm glad to hear that. As far as I know, everything has gone out. So there are a few orders in there still from people who didn't complete their backer kit surveys, which means like we don't have a final address for you. If that's you, email us at info@headstamppublishing.com or just go into backer kit and finish your survey. But those will probably trickle in over the next couple of weeks or months. But yeah, didn't anticipate the Chinese censorship. Like I said, maybe huge naivete on my part, but now it's something that we're thinking about for sure going forward.
Well, I think it's something that we don't think about as Americans. We know about China and we know about how they handle their people and their history and those sort of things. But yeah, we don't think about how it would impact outsider stuff, especially, well, I mean, obviously the workers in the factory would be reading it, but they just get wrapped up and moved on. It's not like you're disseminating leaflets out to the people.
I was hoping we would actually sell a bunch of these books in China. I figured there'd be a It's how many billion people? There've got to be a bunch of them who are interested in their own history and in firearms. And I think it's mostly an internet restriction and linguistic issue, but we got a single digit number of orders in China for the book. Yeah, a little sad, but.
Do any of those look like very official addresses and emails?
No, they did not, which would have been kind of funny. Had we gotten something like that, I think we would have happily taken their money and sent them a book.
Well, that's awesome. And like I said, they've come out absolutely amazing. And something that we talked about in the earlier interviews when you were talking about it, and it pays out, like the technology of the book, which is kind of an interesting thing, because I always think of like books as just being, yeah, it's a book and books are books, and we got, you know, different materials and you know, different, you know, colors and printing styles and things like that. But like the fact that, yeah, you've got full page, you know, two page essentially centerfold style, you know, images of these like high resolution photographs that are absolutely gorgeous, and you can open the book and lay it down and nothing gets lost in the crease between the pages, which is outstanding. I mean, just you mentioned that and I went, oh, that seems neat. And that was like the first thing I did when I was looking through my copy is go, wow, that is really, really nice. Because as someone who, I mean, I'm a marine biologist, so like I had all of these like Jacques Cousteau book, you know, coffee table books and every little like coral reef photography coffee books, which are just dime a dozen. Like I'd get them for like a buck at like a book sale somewhere and I just eat them up. But yeah, there'd be a huge picture and just like 10% of it would be completely lost in that crease.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a specific binding technique that you can use that not only means that you can see all the way into the center of the book, but it also means you can open the book up and set it down and the pages don't start flipping on their own, which is also really nice.
Yeah, that is really, really cool. And actually, another thing that I heard you mention was that like you're one of the few publishers that do gilding on the pages.
I mean, there are some out there who do it, but you certainly don't see firearms books with gilded pages.
No, no. I was just wondering about. So that's more. That was more of a statement towards the firearms coffee table / reference books.
Yeah, yeah. It just doesn't seem to be a thing that people are interested in, and frankly, I can kind of understand why. A lot of this sort of stuff, things like spine hubs and the decorative elements we have on the cover and the page gilding, actually make it fairly tricky to find a good printer. Mm-hmm. There are, you know, like we would love to have taken this out of China and done it in Taiwan or Vietnam or frankly anywhere outside of China. And it turned out to just literally be impossible for us because of the decorative elements, the complex elements in the book and the physical size. We could not find an alternative printer. We've looked in the US. We have some books that we've printed in the US. Overall, frankly, to be honest, the cost of printing in China is substantially less than in the US, although the cost of transport from China to the US mostly makes that all back. There's not necessarily a huge cost difference between the US and China in that regard. But we have actually found substantially higher quality from Chinese printers, which is a real bummer. If it were possible to do it, there'd be a ton of advantages to printing all of our stuff in the US. We just literally can't. Some printers just aren't interested in even attempting a complex project like this. And the ones we have used, we've had substantially more QC problems that we've had to go back and deal with fixing.
So what I'm hearing is you created Headstamp Publishing because you felt that there was a vacuum for this style of firearms reference books. And so you just decided to make your own. So what you're saying is your next project is going to be an actual, you know, bookbinding and printing factory.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, no, but giant sigh. Yes.
Well, I mean, that's awesome. I'm so glad you overcame it. And like, yeah, as you said, COVID hit right at the start and you luckily got in under the radar and then China kind of caught you by surprise. But the books have arrived and they are amazing and they're available for regular retail purchase at Headstamp, correct?
Yes, that is correct. We printed plenty to have a good supply of them for a while.
Did you sell any orders to like bookstores or anything like that? Is there a chance that you might find that at your local book collectors?
There is only one reseller that we have, and that is Varustelika in Finland.
Okay.
They purchased a batch from us at wholesale. An arrangement we specifically did because they can ship throughout Europe far cheaper than we can, because they're in Europe. And so that is definitely the better option. If you're listening to this and you want to get a copy of the book and you're in Europe, go to Varustelika in Finland and get it from them, because they can give you a much better overall deal on it than we can from the U.S. Other than that, no, we only sell directly ourselves.
Well, excellent. Well, then there will be a link in the show notes to Headstamp Publishing. And I mean, of course, Ian, you are not a hard man to find on the internet.
Well, I suppose not.
Well, thank you so much for coming on, and congratulations on your publication.
Thank you very much.
You know, as he was talking about all the problems he had with Chinese censorship, I was thinking about that one particular YouTube channel, Laowai86, who lived there for 10 years. And it's like, yeah. And like Ian, I was really shocked that they didn't dig deeper. And maybe it's because the book was in English and most Chinese don't speak English, but they can sure read pictures. I don't know, but for whatever reason, yeah, he got really lucky, and I'm glad.
Yeah. It's, I don't blame him, for it's something that you really don't think about, especially since they had published several other books before that with no issue, 'cause it wasn't about China. This book is really amazing. It's pricey. They're spendy, but I gotta say, they are worth every penny, just for all the reasons that we talked about in the interview. And furthermore, Ian is currently crowdfunding the next Headstamp Publishing book, which is Clockwork Basilisk, and the links are the links to that book are in the show notes. And I look forward to talking to Ian about that one in the next episode.
That is a really cool title. I have no idea what it's about, but that sounds like, well, you're very fond of a band called Steampunk Giraffe.
Yes, Steam-Powered Giraffe, correct.
Oh, Steam-Powered Giraffe.
Yes.
Well, I'm just saying it's in that particular genre, and I really like that. You know, it either sounds like a band or a really cool alternate history science fiction, maybe mixed in with some fantasy novel. I have no idea what it's about. Do you know what it's about?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. It is about essentially one of the first single action revolvers ever created. The man who created these first essentially mechanically linked repeating pistols that first started off as flintlocks. And so the basilisk could either kill or turn to stone with its sight. And these were things that could kill by looking at it, and they were all full of clockwork.
Nifty.
It is a great title. It is an absolutely great title.
It's a banger. I love it. Speaking of bangers, Weird is here with his fourth Fisk of Brady Anti-Gun Twaddle.
So here comes part four of my Fisk series on the Brady campaign's attempt to refute pro-gun Second Amendment argument.
Point number five. We need to talk about the real causes of gun violence. Things like social media, or video games, or rap music.
Well, that's just bullshit. Of course, it also isn't a straw man argument. NRA's own Wayne LaPierre himself called out violent video games after the Sandy Hook shooting. And of course, there are people who call out rap music for more racial reasons. So while it's a stupid argument, it is an argument being made. But it's also an argument being made by the anti-gunners. In ACP episode 223, we talked about Project Unloaded, a Joyce Foundation-affiliated gun control group looking to target video games for promoting gun violence. It's just as much crap when they say it, too.
Yeah, okay, well, I can't wait to dive into this one. But first, for folks listening to the podcast, you might be familiar with my voice because I serve as one of the co-hosts of Red, Blue, and Brady, I'm also a member of Team Legal. And for this question, most importantly, I'm Director of Racial Justice here at Brady.
Just a reminder, I did a FISC on Kelly Sampson as she testified for gun control in front of Congress for episode 215. She's no stranger to lies and bending the truth.
So this is something that we hear all the time, and it's something that you all probably hear a lot of times, which is it's a cultural problem. And embedded in that idea of a cultural problem, it's about rap music. It's about video games. Well, it's just not true. People have actually studied this. First and foremost, the United States of America is part of a globalized planet. So the video games that people play here, people play all over the world. The rap music that people play here, guess what? People listen to it all over the world. There's a theme here. We are not unique in the culture that we consume.
She's 100% correct. Rap music, violent video games, and violent movies are ubiquitous in any nation that has reliable electricity. Ironically, the third world nations where power isn't as common or reliable often have much higher murder and violent crime rates than the United States. But also, pop culture isn't just a synonym for culture. Think of all the violent cities in America, and what do they have in common? Gangs. Gang culture is a culture of violence. And before the pearl clutchers think I'm somehow doing a dog whistle that indicates that certain races are somehow prone to violence, note that I live in Metro Boston, and the Irish and Italian gangs have been causing trouble in the streets long before the Bloods, the Crips, the Latin Kings, or MS-13 were even a thing. David would also like to remind us of all the Jewish-run gangs. Murder, Inc. out of New York got started in the 1920s by Jewish gangsters Meyer Lansky and Bugsy Siegel. And of course, across the pond in Asia, triads and the Yakuza have been stirring up trouble since well before the United States was even a thing. So no, violent video games, movies, or music do not correlate with violent crime. But growing up where your primary role models are street thugs, hitmen, drug dealers, and gang enforcers is a very real issue in this and many other countries.
So the difference maker is not rap lyrics or video games or fast food or anything of that nature. It's firearms. And we know this because people have actually looked into it. Because these claims are so popular in terms of red herrings, people have actually studied whether or not video games lead to gun violence. And they found that they don't. They've actually looked into rap music and found it doesn't really contribute to gun violence. So
she's completely right. And we need to help her with this message, as there are people on our side who are propagating this nonsense. But we also need to bring attention to the actual culture of violence that is prevalent in all the places where you hear gunshots at night. And people like Kelly are demanding more gun control in attempts to solve it.
When you hear arguments that are pointing to culture, there's a few things that are going on there. Usually it's assuming that the United States lives on a cultural island, when in fact, of all the countries in the world, for us, it's the exact opposite. Because we are sort of this global leader, a lot of our culture is exported everywhere. It also assumes that we know about a shooter. And so be on the lookout for, you know, in the moments after shooting, someone will say it's video games. Well, how do you even know the person plays video games in the first place? Let alone the fact that video games don't cause gun violence. So these are, whether they're well-intentioned, ill-intentioned, they're trying to divert from the real issue, which is that what is unique about the United States is not the music that we listen to. It's the unregulated and relatively easy access to firearms that sets us apart.
Or the cultural aspects of the United States that you are completely ignoring. Plus, it's not like this is uniquely American. There are gangs in England, gangs in France, gangs in Germany, and oh man, are there gangs in Ukraine. The mafia is still strong in Italy. And I was told by a Tokyo resident that when you see someone dressed in Yakuza garb, maybe flashing their tattoos, give them a wide berth, because despite Japan's strict gun laws, those boys probably have guns. Those are your anti-gun talking points, and some garbage pro-gun talking points, and some rebuttals to combat them. So, Aaron, how did this one rank?
Well, I'm not in the best mindset right now. It still hasn't beaten your best one, but still pretty good. And I have saved my own personal copy of this to Google Docs.
Nice.
So anytime I save your stuff to my personal file, you have done a good job.
Well, good. I'm glad. And yeah, this one was actually a little bit more challenging because normally I get a little bit more snarky. And I found myself actually when I was writing out the script for it, writing about it being a straw man and then having to delete that because I'm like, it's not a straw man. Like everything she is saying is said by some pro gunners. And they will, a lot of the arguments are arguments that really aren't made or are arguments that are absolutely made and they're going to completely misinterpret them. But absolutely these racist arguments and or just completely fabricated arguments such as violent video games making people violent. If violent video games made people violent, we would all be like ducking for cover right now. And so we need to stand up for exactly what she's saying in those where when people are saying like Wayne LaPierre are saying that violent video games are responsible for the Sandy Hook massacre. No, it's not. But at the same time, she's saying these things that aren't that are true, but gun control is not the answer.
Is it ever the answer, Weird?
Nope. Not even remotely. Unless you mean using both hands, in which case, yes. Or in the case of using a rifle, getting that good cheek weld. I was out at the range the other day with my newbie gun buddy. And I was showing him like, here, putting the rifle stock up on my cheek. Look, see a little jowly action that happens as the cheek squishes against the stock. You need to be like this. You need to really get your face in there because that holds it steady. And you know who else holds us steady, Aaron?
Our lovely, kind, generous, and fertile patrons.
Correct. They do. We want to thank all of our listeners, but we do want to thank our very special thanks to our lovely Patreon patrons. I got a little distracted there because I caught a glimpse of them and they're really good looking, Aaron. They're like all very, very good looking people. And if you want to be a good looking person too, because let's face it, you've looked in the mirror. You could use a little work. Go to patreon.com/assortedcalibers podcast to sign up. Patrons get early release of the podcast, plus bonus content like the hilarious blooper reels, the ACP film track, the ACP bag dump, and they instantly become better looking.
I still feel called out by that mirror remark. Also, please remember to rate us on Apple Podcasts, subscribe to us on the platform of your choice, and share the show with your friends both online and off.
I got a blog. It's called weirdworlds.com. And I'm also on a show called Handgun Radio. It's all right.
And you can get me. And you can get more from me at linktree.com/Aaron Paulette. That's linktr.ee/Aaron Paulette. All one word.
And thanks to Nate Spencer for our music.
I like to eat turkey and he likes to drink wild turkey. Our turkey consumption is assorted, and so is our podcast. Happy Thanksgiving, everyone.
Happy Thanksgiving.